And all right, welcome everybody. It is December 2nd. This is the fourth in this year's series. I named it Napoleon and the Jews. So the only thing is I got a little sidetracked. So I hope we'll get back to the Jews, but in certain respects we will. But there was so much to Napoleon. I'd like to focus in on one thing tonight, and that's going to lead to everything, and that's the Battle of, if I'm saying it correctly, the Battle of Austerlitz. So we'll get up to that. That was in 1804, I believe that was the battle. 1806. All right, anyway, just an opening with a story. I remember hearing this story, I don't know, I was a kid, so I saw somebody had written it out. So there's a story told about Emperor Napoleon, who one August evening while walking through the streets of Paris. So when I heard it, I don't know if it was the streets of Paris. In Paris there weren't too many Jews, so maybe he passed the one shul that was there. I heard he was on, it could have been on one of his raids that was going on, and he was in a Jewish section. But the story is that he heard sounds of people praying and weeping from a shul, passing by a synagogue. Turning to one of his aides, a Jewish officer, the emperor asked, "What's going on in there?" "Tonight is Tisha B'Av," came the reply. "The Jews are mourning the destruction of their holy temple." Napoleon Bonaparte was dumbfounded. "I pride myself in having one of the world's most sophisticated intelligence networks," he said. "If the Jews' temple was destroyed, surely someone would have told me. When did this happen?" The officer replied, "Over 1,700 years ago." Napoleon stroked his chin for a few moments and then said, "If the Jews are still crying after so many years, then this must be a religion based on deep beliefs, tradition, and character. I am sure that the Jewish people will endure, and that one day the temple will be restored." That's the way the story goes. I know why, if Napoleon said it, it means more to people than others. But that's the way the story goes. Okay. So just a little bit continuing where we left off. We left off last week where the end of the Egyptian campaign. In reality, the Egyptian campaign for Napoleon was a disaster. It really was a failure overall. In inland, he was very successful with his battles, and the idea again was he was trying to do war, undermine the British. When the British fleet came, it took out his French ships, and he had to end the campaign. The only thing that was helpful, very interesting to the Jewish people, is had he been able to conquer Akko, he was planning to go to Yerushalayim, and like we mentioned last time, a proclamation that the Jews can come to Yerushalayim, settle, build their temple, and just, that's it. He was giving them Eretz Yisrael, Palestine, a land that he did not own yet, but he was anticipating, and he was going to give it to them. And it was just, it's interesting how history repeats itself, because before World War I, or during World War I, the British did the exact same thing. The Balfour Declaration. In order to get the Jews' support, they said, "Well, we feel strongly that Palestine should be the homeland for the Jews." At the time that they made the proclamation, Palestine was under the Turks. And then just so happened after the war, England ended up with Palestine. And the Jews said, Balfour Declaration, that's and now. The British had to do a lot of backtracking, but that's way, way, way down. That's not our story. But while he was in Egypt, So when he heard that there was unrest in Paris, in France, he left, basically he left his army. He said, figure it out. And they did. I think they somehow surrendered. They came through some accommodation with British, and they just basically left. I guess, I don't know, British let them. They had some passage out, but basically they left the Middle East, and that was it with them. They never came back. Just one thing is, while he was in Egypt, so the year or two before, he had conquered northern Italy and had freed all the Jews from their ghettos. Freed the Jews from, in other words, he broke down the ghettos, and he said, then took off their armbands, and they said, you can go and do whatever you want. When Napoleon and the French army left, so the locals went back and they took their wrath out against the Jews. He's going to reconquer that area, and then the Jews are going to be secure until 1815, when Napoleon is totally deposed. But that's just a little thing about Italy. In 1799, he hears that there's a unrest, and Napoleon does is, he stages a coup d'etat. Did I say it right? Mm-hmm. Okay, coup d'etat. He stages an overthrow of the French Republic, and he assumes power as dictator. The French people voted in favor of a new constitution that made Napoleon consul of France. So for the last 4 years, the government looked like this under the Directory. It was an executive. There were five directors appointed by the legislator. The legislator had two houses, a lower house of 500 members, an upper house, 250 members. Initially, those members, most of them came from the convention, from one of the earlier forms of the government. This has been going on since 1792. So we're now in 1790, about 7 years. And one government, one form goes to the next, and but however, this time, in order not to have the Jacobins or the lower class and Robespierre with the beheading of all the enemies, so they made it that you can only vote. This is the directive. It was all before Napoleon. You can only vote if you own land. And you can only basically write to vote and hold office if you're a landowner. I guess at that time and that place, the most radicals were from the poor. So in order not to let these radicals have power again, or to limit their power, only if you have land you can vote. And that's basically when they did that, the Girondists, the middle class party, they gained control. They may have gained control of the government, but things were still not working. It was still, the economy was a mess, and things weren't working. There was corruption in the government, and there was more and more unrest. And when Napoleon, who was in Egypt at the time, heard this, and things weren't going well in his Akko campaign, so he ran back to France, and he made himself what you call, he made three consuls. That was the new government. He was consul number one. Number one was Napoleon Bonaparte, and there was a second and third consul. Like, I don't even want to even try mentioning their names, but I guess I will. Jean Jacquet Regis Cambaceres, and Charles Lebrun. He went to basketball, I guess. So these were the second and third these are the second and third consuls, and that's what it was. That's what it was running the government. And this is the way it was for about a year or so. After a year, he put out a vote for the people, and basically his vote, the question was, as of now, Napoleon is first consul. Do you want to keep voting, having to vote for him in, or was he consul for life? And being what a hero he was, I mean, for every, they idolized Napoleon. I mean, victory after victory. He was able to keep his loss, his debacle in the Middle East, in Egypt, a secret, so they still didn't know how bad that went. But other than that, every place he went, that he was so so victorious, and so they actually voted him first consul for life. One of the things that were before Napoleon came in is that still religion was on the out. The radicals of the Republic, and they felt that the church was with the old, the king and the old, and the nobles, and they were all together against the people, right? That's how they and therefore they threw out the church and they threw out the nobles and the first estate, which was the church. They, when Napoleon came back, so one of the things he did right away is he made up with the Christian church, which was brilliant on his part. Like, why does he has enough enemies, and we're going to go through all the coalition enemies against him. But one of the things he did is he took away the argument of those against the Napoleon, those against the Republic, by saying, look what they did, they threw out religion. So what he did is he made a concordat with a concordance with Pope Pius. He brought him into France. He said, listen, I'm giving you back, you know, your Christianity is in, okay? We'll give you back your you could open up all the churches. People can go to church. People could be religious. He himself personally was not religious. But, you know, that's it. He was fine. He was okay with people being religious, people being Christian. And I don't know how much of the land that they owned was given back to the church. He also put the church under the government. We mentioned this last time. He had the he paid the salaries. He gave, the government decided what every priest's salary is going to be. And the government paid it, unlike the Jews, when they're going to decide what the salaries are going to be, but they're not going to pay it. He also made up with the Calvinists and the Protestants and Lutherans, all these other sects. He made peace with them. And now everybody was able to openly worship, including the Jews. So during the past few years, the Jews were, of course, there were minyanim, but there were no shuls. And they were just davening in shtibles, or like, you know, like I guess we had to do during COVID, you know. You had to get a minion here or whatever. So that's the way they were. But now everything was out in the open, and things were even were better for the Jews. Okay, so I just 1802, he had different treaties of amends, Napoleon. And also in 1802, Napoleon restructures the French educational system. So things that weren't working well, now that Napoleon was in charge, he made things work well. He says, okay, let's get the educational system, public school. And he got the right people. And again, one of the main things he would do is he was looking for people. It was a merit-based hierarchy. You know, if you did a good job, you got promoted, whereas in the old estate, in the old way, it was nepotism. You know, you knew somebody, or you related to the king, or some royal person, or some noble, and that's how you got put up. But no, this was so. The educational system got an upgrade. New constitution adopted, and in 1802. Napoleon is first consul for life. 1803, we mentioned this before, was the Louisiana Purchase. I guess he needed some money to fund some sort of a war. Okay, and this, all right. This was also probably a little bit against England, because again, the United States had broken away from England. France helped the with the the war of the independent war against England, and they sent there a few French generals. So the Louisiana Purchase. British declares war also in 1803, but British always declared war, and France invades Hanover, which is in Germany. 1804, he introduces the Civil Code, which is also help for the government, help for the people. What are the rights of the people of France? Napoleon proclaimed emperor of the Jewish people by the Senate. So now he's now gone beyond first consulate, and in 1804 he decides, you know what, been there, done that, I think I'm going to be emperor. Okay, let's try that for a bit. So now he proclaimed himself emperor, and we mentioned this before, he does this ceremoniously, brings the Pope. The Pope is going to crown him as emperor. Okay, he orders election, and the French people voted Napoleon emperor for life. You know, okay, that was the, so he did, at least made an election. Hitler did something like that too. After he was chancellor, then he made a fire, and he says, no, we need emergency situation, and then he declared himself a dictator. So, but at least Napoleon made himself a, okay, in 1804, crowns himself emperor, but and we mentioned also, he didn't, the plan was that the Pope would stand up and put the crown on his head, but that's not exactly what happened. As the Pope was there, he took the crown out of the Pope's hand and he put it on his own head. So I guess he had the Pope there. As for the ceremony, to give it chashivas, it says people waited for over a day, waited online to get there, it was cold, it was raining. But he knew how to do that. He knew how to make big events, make things. He crowns his wife, Josephine, as well. Was this his second wife? Was this the other one? I don't remember. Huh? This is the first one. So, okay. Signifies the power of the Catholic Church. Okay. And this is now his new government. He, as emperor, so instead of having the different directorates, you know, he's in charge. So he has on the one hand, he has these prefects and they manage departments. He has sub-prefects and they manage districts, but he chooses everybody. But the sub-prefects, they don't answer to the emperor, they answer to the prefects. He has his ministers and they answer only to the emperor. He breaks up mayors of municipalities. If they have more than 5,000 people, he chooses them. But he chooses them from a certain list. He had a list of all males in France. I'm guessing if there were 25 million, 30 million people, so males were probably about, let's say, 12, 13 million. So then you had a communal list. I don't know how they got it down, but the 10% of that communal list was 1.3 million. He had a department list, a tenth of that, which was 130,000. And the national list was 13,000. From the 13,000, this national list, working from the top, the emperor chooses the Senate, who's going to be in the Senate, and they decide the constitutionality of the laws. The Council of State, they make the laws. They write the laws, the Senate debates on the laws, and then it's given to a tribunate and a legislative assembly. And they vote if the one is 100 members, 300 members, they will take over the national list and they discuss the laws and how to put them all in order.
They were all picked by Napoleon?
Pretty much.
Wow.
Pretty much. He picked Napoleon. I'm sure he had help.
Yeah.
But once they're all picked from Napoleon, yeah, you can understand it's a government that's going to be very friendly to Napoleon.
Right.
I mean, he, besides being an emperor and a general, I mean, he technically did have the power just to kill people right and left if he wanted to.
Right.
Okay. Okay, mayors of municipality less than 5,000, they were chosen all from this communal list. They answered to these, they were answerable to the mayors of for the prefects also. They were integral to the prefects. So he divided bigger cities and smaller cities. Smaller cities he didn't care as much, and bigger cities didn't have an effect for the Jews, depending on the areas that they lived in, where they're going to have to go. Okay, so in these few years that he was there, Napoleon is going to improve the government. He's going to fix the economy. He introduces the Bank of France. And okay, now he's able to regulate the money. It helps for the economy. He creates a system, again, merit-based. He creates public schools. He also the code. So all this is done in like 2-3 years. I mean, this is, he really doesn't have, it's really amazing that he's able to do this, because he was constantly leading his army in battles. So with all of the armies that are going on and battles that are going on, and it's not just one country, there are coalitions. So he had like 2-3 years where he got all this going. He also fixed up the parks, unified France. You know, that was another thing that that he was able to do. Also, it helps the economy when you do it right and you get people working. Then, once they get working, they get money. They're able to spend, and it just helps with it helps bring down inflation. The civil code we spoke about. Okay, so this was all done by Napoleon. This is all being done while he's fighting a series of wars. Now, if you look over here, there are really 7 coalition wars. So the wars that he fought wasn't just like against one nation. The first 2 coalitions were really coalitions against his, not really against him, but against the Republic. Okay, in 1792, when they first started this, there were the other emperors and kings. They were afraid, they didn't want this French a republic idea to go, you know, to get go out, so they did a war. In the second coalition, he was already the general, and this he fought. This was already in northern France, and but it was he did not take power yet. The third coalition war. Now, in the second coalition war, again in 1799, that's pretty much when he became emperor. Not emperor, but he took over the government. He was originally first consul. So, but the third coalition in 1805 is when they were after Napoleon. This is post-Napoleon government. And now it's over here, he had from 1802 to 1805. So in those 3 years is when he did his domestic policies. Just, if it's a good question, otherwise afterwards, I just...
Who's he fighting?
One more slide. I got to that. Just that the seventh coalition, this is after he was, he escaped from one island and he came back, and they went to arrest him, the French soldiers, and then they saw him, and then they decided to join him. So for about 100 days, he had an army, and then everybody said, enough is enough, and they got him. That was the Battle of Waterloo. It was in France itself. And then they sent him to some other island further away, where he died a few years later. But, okay, so the third coalition is where I really want to focus in on, because this is the coalition that's going to make him, like, this is what's going to change everything. The face of Europe. Everything that, from the old to the new, is all going to be his defeat of the Third Coalition. So if you want to know just who he was up against, just as an idea, this is the different coalitions. First coalition, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. And this is where, in the first coalition, these were his campaigns. Blue means he won. Green were undecisive. And red was he lost. Okay? Haitian Revolution, Gumbo War, these were in America. So in the American continent, he didn't do too well. He sort of gave up on that. This was in Spain, this was the Egyptian campaign. But he's really going to be really doing well, even into 1810. And then he's going to, in 1812, he's going to, this is what's going to do him in, his invasion of Russia. That's what, that is going to do. Okay, and who was he up against? Well, okay, in the first coalition, and just to go and show you, I have three slides of this. This is Great Britain, Holy Roman Empire, and I'll just come back to it again. But these are all these different countries that he had to fight, that he was fighting. Great Britain comes in on every one of them. That's the only one. Now, if you see white, it's because they didn't exist. So the Holy Roman Empire, and this is at the end of the Third Coalition, ceased to exist. He put an end to the Holy Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. Germany, as it was, did not exist. I mean, there was a country, Germany, there were a few states, but the Holy Roman Empire, which was all of these different city-states together, did not, that's it, he put an end to it. In them were a number of these small city-state countries which were aligned with him at first. There's Baden, Bavaria, Nassau, Saxony, Württemberg, Black Brunswickers, Hanover, and the Austrian Empire. So if you were white, it means you didn't exist, so to speak. I mean, Austria did exist. But now Austria Empire, and they join the Third Coalition, and they're going to be the ones that are really going to take it hard. Gray means you didn't join the coalition. And just go to the next one. Spain, Ottoman Empire. I'm surprised he even joined the second one, but okay, they mainly stayed out of it. Russia from the second, third, fourth, and sixth. They're going to be Tuscany, Malta, Order of St. John, Naples, Sicily, Netherlands, Sweden, Switzerland. Do I have another one? No. Okay, so you get an idea. He's fighting Europe. All the while, he's where he is, and he's being very, very successful. I mean, he's holding them off. He is the most brilliant general that there is around. And everyone knew he was good, that he was the general, but there was one battle that changed everything. If you could point to one battle that changed Europe, it was going to be the Battle of Austerlitz. So this is in 1805, before the Battle of Austerlitz. This is what it would have looked like. Okay, you have the French Empire, Spain's going to take over. We'll see what it looks like 5 years later. But this is what all this area is known as the Roman Holy Roman Empire. This was it. All these, at one point there was about 300 little city-state countries that there were. Prussia was pretty big. Austria was pretty big. This is northern Italy, would be around over here. Okay, so this is what it looked like in 1805, and then came the Third Coalition. Who came in on the Third Coalition? You had the Austrian Empire, you had Great Britain, the Holy Roman Empire, Austria, Russia, Naples, Sicily, and Sweden. But the Battle of Austerlitz was really known as the Battle of the Three Emperors. Okay. So this is 1805, just before we get to the earlier in the year. He got himself stuck in Spain. Probably a big mistake. But he ended up, he first was helping Spain with something, and then he decided to take it over. So then he was having problems with Portugal. But Spain never really accepted him, and they never really had a good hold on Spain. That's just a side thing. That was a... Okay, Battle of Austerlitz, if I'm saying it correctly, which was in December of 1805, Battle of the Three Emperors.
Today's the anniversary.
Huh?
Today's the anniversary.
Oh, look at that. Oh my gosh. Look at this. I just happened to have picked it. Okay, okay. So
you
the
had one earlier also.
Huh?
You had one earlier also when he was appointed emperor.
It was also December 2nd?
December 2nd.
Look at that.
Right at the beginning.
Look at that, okay.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah,
so.
And France was in this week's Haftorah.
That's
okay. Which I pointed out earlier.
Okay, that's good. They, okay. So now here we are. This is the Battle of Austerlitz. Now, the Battle of Austerlitz was, it ended up that he won with the Treaty of Pressburg again, and that treaty changed a lot. Okay, the main two armies he was against was Austria and Russia, and it went something like this. If this was the battleground, so first what he did is he so much wanted Russia and Austria to attack him. So he had his battle lines here. He actually wanted, what he did is he purposely weakened his right flank. And he also had the height, these heights, I forgot what it's called, the heights of, these certain areas, and he actually abandoned them. He also spread out misinformation, you know, that he's in total disarray. So all these sending, you know, like starting to send messages, they're having a hard time of things, and the army is not doing well, and you could see that things here are just, he put very few soldiers here, and he lined up all this, and the Russians and the Austrians fell for it, and they said, oh my gosh, let's take a look at what's happening, look at this. And they figured if we can go ahead and attack on the right flank and we can come up and surround them, the rest of the army, we'll have a good day. It'll be a good battle. And that's what he wanted them to do. Mm. And sure enough, they in fact did attack. And when they attacked, basically what he did is he took his main army and went right through the center. And he split the army in two. So he had this, you know, this was a fight that was going on, and they were chasing on the right flank, and at some point he held the right flank strong. He ended up coming straight down the middle, split the two armies, and that's it. He just it was such a trouncing that he captured tens of thousands of soldiers, and it was it. He finished off the Austrian army, and he finished off the Russian army.
How did they cross that high point in the center? So
they took it.
The
heights
would have been the obstacle.
Yeah, no, these were the heights. They actually let them take it. So they wanted them. They were feigning. They were making believe we're weak. So they would in fact attack. And they will, you know, they trick them into attacking, into thinking that they're weaker on the right side, and in fact they weren't. And that's how they were able to do it. That was one of the things they did. Okay, he was clearly outnumbered. I mean, they had more guns, they had more soldiers, they had more of everything. And he was able to just totally rout them. It was a tremendous victory. This is one of his greatest victories. I said it. And then he also used his horses. He knew how to use guns and horses, everything, to such perfection. He used them to surround them. It was a trance. He totally defeated them. Okay. This pretty much what I said. It's just in more detail. Okay. France and Austria agreed to an armistice. And it was called the Treaty of Pressburg on December 26th. This took Austria out of the war and the coalition, and whatever treaties that they had after the second coalition, the Campo Formia, and I don't know how to say this, Lunéville, and that's it. Everything was done. It confirmed that Austrian loss, he gave back everything from northern Italy, and basically Bavaria, France, and Germany, and he basically, Austria is no longer a force or a power that was there. He charged them 40 million golden franc. He allowed the fleeing Russian troops free passage to get through. In other words, he really wasn't so much against Russia. And as a matter of fact, at one point he had some sort of an alliance with Russia. The problem with Russia was that he was trying to isolate England, and he had the intercontinental blockade, and Russia was cheating, and that's when he didn't like the fact that Russia was cheating on the blockade, so he figured, let me take out Russia, and then it'll help. Portugal was also cheating, and Sweden, he couldn't do too much to Sweden. Those three countries were coming in on the side of Great Britain. It just led to the next coalition against them. But what ended up happening is the map of Europe changed. And in order to protect France, he took apart the entire Holy Roman Empire. The emperor abdicated the throne, and instead he ended up making a confederation of states. And in 1810, this is what the map would have looked like. Okay, he created from northern Germany, Kingdom of Westphalia. He had the Confederation of the Rhine. So he basically broke up the Holy Roman Empire and made different empires. Kingdom of Italy, Kingdom of Naples, Kingdom of Denmark. All these were different areas, all ruled or run by France. He had the Kingdom of Spain, the Austrian Empire. So what he did is he took a lot of his brothers and sisters and had them rule different areas. Joseph Napoleon's older brother would be the King of Spain. Okay, and again, for 5 years, that's the way it was, but once Spain rebels, and that's it, they're all going to lose their positions, for sure, after Napoleon is gone. His stepson ruled Italy. That's this area here. His sister was Duchess of Tuscany. Okay. That's also, I think, in Italy, if I'm not mistaken. We'll get back to Jordan in a second. But Louis Napoleon was the King of Holland. So these two, I'm going to come back to, and Jerome was the King of Westphalia. So the King of, we're going to come back to these two, because it's going to have the Jewish communities there are going to use these kings to further their what they want, their interests. Okay, whether one is Jerome is going to be taken in by Isaac Jacobson, who's going to be the father of reform, and Louis Napoleon is going to sort of go with the old established Jewish community against the new up and coming one. But these two are going to happen during these times. Yes?
It's interesting because he permanently changed Europe to Austria. Austria was huge. And he pretty much to this day is in the shadows. This Roman thing.
It's not going to be so because Austria-Hungary, I mean, they're going to be the big major players in World War I. Mm-hmm.
But eventually they basically. But he took the first blow, and then they took another blow.
Right.
And that Roman thing's out of there, and all the language barrier is what has been a huge obstacle. You know, you're going to go in Spain and tell you we're taking it over, we're a French country, you don't speak the language.
We mentioned also one of the biggest things was this nationalism. Patriotic nationalism that France sort of developed among themselves, so it worked against them, because if there's French nationalism, and that's where they were able to fight out all foreigners, so the same thing happened in Spain. They said, hey, we're Spanish, we're going to let a bunch of French rule us.
Yeah, we're Spanish.
We're German, we're going to let the French rule us. So eventually each of these leaders are going to have a hard time. They're foreign leaders. And they're not gonna. The countries are gonna rebel, but they were only there because of Napoleon. And when Napoleon fell, then for sure, we'll see what happened. In 1812, this is what his empire looked like. He had the largest empire since the Roman Empire. Okay, all the way from Spain in the east, all the way to Russia, Ukraine, I guess. This is all the way in the west. Okay, and in the south, all of Italy, and it bordered, it had the Ottoman Empire, was its biggest bordered, and it took the entire, basically the entire Rome, entire Europe. And if you see over here, this like blue line, that was his, that was, he was trying to isolate Great Britain, that they could not do any trade with Europe, and that was his point. But when Portugal were cheap and Russia were cheap, so he couldn't really effectively done it. Yeah.
It seems like he didn't do much on the Ottoman Empire line.
Right.
He you know, that kind of like stayed steady.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he didn't do too much.
He just didn't that,
right. Hey, as a matter of fact, I was even surprised. It seems that Ottoman joined in the second coalition. But maybe they learned their lesson. They said, look, this is a Christian war. What do we need to deal with it, you know? So they stayed out. Also, keep in mind, this area here of Poland just in 1792 was divided. It was totally taken, dismantled between Austria, Russia, and I believe it was Prussia. They all just divided. There's no more Poland. It exists. When Napoleon came in, he actually made a Duchy of Warsaw because he figured maybe he can be able to bring it back out of, you know, of what it was. I mean, he was kicking out countries that just recently had taken it over. So in that area, there was a lot of chaos to begin with. It wasn't like a strong country. Okay, this is what it looked like in 1812. But just, you know, when you look over here, look was where his army was starting to go to Moscow.
It was Austrian Empire is part of him or no?
Austria was part of the empire, right?
Why did they make them yellow? I see they're within the border.
Right, because he didn't rule it. It was just an ally now. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, I think his second wife was one of the empresses of Austria, and he did that in order to solidify. Uh-huh. It was a political marriage. He also did it because he wanted a male heir. He didn't have a son from his wife, so he took on this younger Austrian, you know, and just that was the point of it. But it never got that far, huh?
He didn't get the son.
No. He was taken out way before that. Okay, so this is what it looked like. So now when his army, which he took from all of his countries to go on to Russia, his campaign is going to be 600,000 men, mostly from France. So 600,000, that wasn't men, but an army of 600,000. He had families, he had women coming, constantly cooking, you know, yeah. I can only imagine the logistics of this, but that's what did him in. He started his army with 600,000. He came back with 40,000.
Yeah. Well,
you don't lose a half a million, and just. But there were a lot of there were a lot of defects. You know, people just defected back to their countries. You know, if you had some Austrians and they didn't want to fight anymore. So their 10,000 man army would just run away back to Austria. So you had, I don't know if you had 100,000 that ran away like that. I don't know what the numbers are, but many did. But he lost a lot on you know, they were captured and
it finished off Germany also. Who's going to mess with Russia? You know, they're too vast and too popular.
Right, right. That's it. Right. The old joke is never start a land war in Russia, right? You know, in Asia. Right.
And they were very good with the scorched earth.
Right, scorched earth. They scorched everything, so he was not able. Plus, they had the Cossacks that were constantly harassing them. Napoleon actually said, he said, he doesn't understand when they were attacking him or coming too close to France. He was wondering, how come my French don't attack, you know, the Russian armies or the coalition armies like the Cossacks harassed my army out in Russia? But Cossacks and Russians are different than French. They're Western Europeans and, you know, Russians. Okay, that's what it looked like. Okay. The joint battles afterwards. And this is where we're going to get to the Jews, and probably this is going to set up the everything with his, Napoleon's Jewish policy. And this is what happened. On his way back from Arcelus, he did the most stunning victory. He has now made all these new treaties. He has dismantled the Roman Holy Roman Empire. She's changed the map. Austria has been put in its place. Russia has been sent fleeing. Prussia was at it, didn't involve himself in this war. But now he is the top of the world at this point. You know, he is in charge of everything. On his way back from Austerlitz, he stops in Strasbourg. Now, if you remember before, we mentioned there were about, how many Jews were there in France? It was about 30,000, 40,000 Jews. 40. Of the 40,000 Jews, 3,000 were Sephardim, about 37,000 were Ashkenazim. And of the 37,000, at least three quarters of them lived around Strasbourg.
Huh.
So now he's heading back after his major victory. And he comes into Strasbourg, and the non-Jews there were just kept hounding him. They were complaining so much about the Jews. So he's coming off this victory, and now the people there, they just can't stand what's going on. What's happening here? So one is that they have three tainas, major tainas. And this is gonna shape Napoleon's, a lot of his laws or policies to the Jews. One is that they refuse to assimilate. Ashkenazi, you can imagine, these were from Yidden. These were the same Ashkenazic Yidden that were from Germany. They were a little bit different than Eastern European Jewry, but they were all from at this point. Again, reform is not going to... There's more secular Jews, but it's nothing yet. So the community is from, and they look from, and they dress like religious Jews. And they say these people refuse to assimilate. But also... What also was very hard on the, what was also stood out is it was like about, 10 years, 1789 to 1799, 10 years of this chaos, a republic before Napoleon came in. So France overall was chaotic. You know, you had all these different governments and they weren't strong, a lot of corruption. So, what was happening among the Jewish people? Well, among the Jewish people, you had your same rabbis, Rabbanim, you had your same Besdin, you had your same communal structures. So here, while France was falling apart all over, and you had all these radicals, and you had your 2-3 years of the reign of terror, and everything's going on around, and what's with the Jewish people? They're pretty good. They were, of course they were affected what's going on around them, but overall as a community, they were just going on, they were doing well. Because they had an infrastructure, and they continue whatever their peddling was, whatever their jobs were, it's a small time. And the outside people noticed this. And they said, could you imagine, we're all everything is going crazy. And the economy is going down, and people are killing each other, and we're all going crazy. And look at these Jews. They're a nation within a nation. They're not assimilating. They look different than us. They're able to, they have their self-governing, and they're not French. So they're unpatriotic. That was one thing. The second thing is they're not assimilating, not patriotic at the same time, because they weren't going to the army, or they were able to buy their way out of going to the army. And I think those two really went hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And the third one is that most of the Jews there were still making their living on interest. Most of the Jews were either peddlers, small-time peddlers, a little wagon and selling, vegetables or clothing. It's just small-time peddling and interest. And they were making interest in the people there. They didn't like to pay the interest. Yeah, of course, you don't like to pay the interest. So that's what they were complaining about them to Napoleon. Okay, so now Napoleon, what is Napoleon going to do? Napoleon's going to come back, and next week, I just wanted to do something else before that, but go on another tangent, but next week we're going to discuss...
2 weeks.
In 2 weeks, if that's right, next week is Hanukkah. In 2 weeks, we're going to discuss how Napoleon, brilliant, what he does. He's going to make an assembly of notables, and then he's going to ask them questions, and then based on their results, he's going to call a Sanhedrin, and he's going to come out with his policy for the Jews. That's what's going to happen as a result of this, of his coming after the Battle of Austerlitz. He's now going to focus in on the Jews for the next year or two, and he's going to come up with policies. And it's going to have repercussions for Jews within France and out of France as well. I just wanted to just, on a side thing, I got confused at first. There's Moshe Sofer, right? He's the Chassam Sofer. He had a yeshiva in Pressburg. So as we mentioned before, the Treaty of Pressburg is what ended the Third Coalition. Austerlitz was the Treaty of Pressburg. But what that the Chassam Sofer ended up writing an autobiography about Pressburg under siege. And this is in English, it's put up by CIS, which doesn't exist anymore. I think Feldheim took over it. And it's just an interesting read on what happened. But this is really the Fifth Coalition in 1809. What's really gonna happen is that there's gonna be a battle over Pressburg. And he's gonna have to leave Pressburg like once or twice, and the French are gonna be battling the Austrians, and the battle line is the Danube, there's the Danube River, one of the rivers, on with Pressburg, and the French are gonna constantly be bombing. So in this, with Pressburg, this is the book that CIS translated it from the Chassam Sofer. But there was just a story in there, in this book, it's like one of these Hashkafat Pratis stories. When the Chassam Sofer was a young boy, he was in the city of Mainz, and for a short time, and he lived with a family, and there happened to have been in Mainz, a French army was there as well. This is before Napoleon, before the Republic, I think this is. Anyway, he got friendly with, there's this one French soldier, and his name was, it says it here, Paul de Montfort. And he saw this boy, Moshe Sofer, and he became friendly with the boy, and he begged the boy to teach him French. And he became friendly with him. All right, Moshe Sofer needed this like a hole in his head. He didn't care about the person, but all right, he had to be nice. He was a French, he was a soldier. Okay, whatever, and he taught him French,
German.
And that's, I'm sorry.
German.
I'm sorry, I got it backwards. He taught the French soldier German. Okay, he was from Germany, he knew German, and he said, please teach me German, and he did. He taught him German. He was a nice French soldier, you know, and it's not like he had negative influence on Moshe Sofer, but he had to spend time doing it, and that was it, fine. Okay, now fast forward like 33 years, 1809. There's battles that are going on for a number of months between the Austrians and the French. And in the beginning of the book, it's like so amazing. It seems that the Jewish section, even though they got like hit with like, you know, with the cannonballs here and there, but overall nobody died at least in the very beginning, nobody died directly from the battles. And the homes, okay, they were hit, but they weren't. So it just keeps going on with that. But then after it was all over, it was over by some ceasefire. They made some sort of a ceasefire, and they came to the general, not the emperor of Austria. He was bypassed by a general, and that's it. It was all over, and there was no more war. What happened is there were two Jews, you know, but you had dead people everywhere, on the French side and on the Austrian side, on both sides of the river. So what this guy did is he took a wagon, and every day he would see guns and bullets all over the place, and he would put it in the wagon, and he would go ahead, and he knew somebody, some Austrian, so he would sell stuff to the Austrian army. And that's what he was doing. And one day these two guys got caught. And they got caught, and they were ready to be court-martialed. That's basically what the story was. And they suspected the rabbis, because they're the leaders of the community. They knew of this, and they also took in the rabbis, and they arrested the rabbis. Okay? When the French learned that the Prestonwerder Bezden knew about the weapon operation and didn't report it, they summoned the Chasam Sofer to a military tribunal. In other words, even though Chasam Sofer wasn't part of that Bezden, but they called him in. Okay, when the Chasam Sofer walked into the courtroom, this is a true story, the French officer who headed the tribunal recognized the Chasam Sofer. The French officer who now headed the tribunal was the same one that was living in the home of Mainz, the young Moshe Sofer lived. The officer asked Chasam Sofer to come into a private room where they reconnected, and the officer assured Chasam Sofer that he had nothing to worry about because he knows that he's a fine person. He couldn't have been involved in the weapon smuggling. Okay, and that's basically how he was saved, and instead of court-martialing and killing the two Jews, they were saved as well. During this time, Chasam Sofer came up with a prayer about, for the Austrian government and that they should be saved. That prayer was taken in World War I, in the Austro-Polish War. They took the prayer of the Chasam Sofer and they just upgraded it to Franz Joseph. But that same prayer that it does, I don't have the original, but they took the original and they upgraded it. Okay, so just a side thing with Rav Moshe Sofer, with Pressburg. But Metz Hashem, next week, we're going to be talking,
weeks.
In 2 weeks, we're going to be talking about the Sanhedrin, the notables, what the questions were, how they had to answer these questions. These were not simple questions. They were under a lot of pressure. Who were the leaders, and that's where we're going to be picking it up.
Who was Chasam Sofer?
Chasam Sofer?
Is he in Strasbourg?
No, he
Pressburg.
Was in
Pressburg.
Pressburg.
Is that a city or a region?
Today it's called a different name.
Is it France or it's Germany?
No,
it's in Austria.
Austria. I believe it's in Austria. The name will come to me. It's not called Pressburg anymore. It's called a different name.
Okay,
right? It's probably here somewhere. All right. Anyway, thank you so much. And